Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Katie Wang.
And this morning we are, in the midst of a conversation with author and investigative journalist Christopher Ketchum about his new book, This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption Are Ruining the American West. Chris, are you back with us on the phone?
I'm back with you. I live way out in the countryside. So,
okay.
You know, technology fails out here.
Well, knock on wood, but you're sounding much better already, much more clear from our end already. We appreciate making the effort.
So what I was saying that basically the regulatory agencies tasked with protecting the public lands have failed to do so in terms of really protecting the wild flora and fauna, the biotic complexity, the biodiversity, the air, the health of the soils, air, water, et cetera, et cetera. And so as I saw this, as I saw so much evidence of this on the public lands, I figured there should be some kind of book out there that written not for, you know, the specialists, the scientist or the conservation NGO activist, but for the layman, for the average citizen, describing the threat, describing the damage, and honoring, celebrating, and defending our public land. And so that was the source of the book. That was the genesis of the book.
And when you talk about the federal agencies failing to protect these federal lands, these public lands, what form do you see that taking? Is it, I wonder, is it just, understaffing and lack of resources? Is it negligence, or is it, are you seeing intentional actions there?
It's a combination of all three. It is both these agencies, the Forest Service and the BLM in particular, along with the Fish and Wildlife Service, which manages enormous numbers of wildlife refuges across the West, are generally underfunded. They are certainly not staffed with enough employees to really engage on the landscape on a site-by-site basis to understand what's going on and to protect the land. At the same time, you have a longstanding corrupt relationship between the regulators and the industries that they regulate. So in the case of the Forest Service, it's the logging timber industry. The Bureau of Land Management, it's primarily the livestock industry, public lands grazing operators, and the mining and mining interests, oil and gas drillers, and hard rock mineral extractionists. So you have both the failure of Congress and successive administrations to properly fund the agencies, coupled with the historical corruption of those agencies as a result of their capture by industry.
And where do you see kind of the role of individuals within those organizations? You know, I imagine there are a variety of viewpoints of the folks that are working for the BLM or the rangers for the Forest Service and those kind of people.
Oh, I think the great majority of them are people deeply devoted to their vocation, who love the land, who want to do the right thing, who want to protect the values of biodiversity, of ecosystem health, and are told not to by their higher-ups, who have to answer to politicians, who themselves answer to capitalist interests. So I tell a story in my book about a BLM manager who attended a meeting between BLM district managers across the West and Department of Interior lawyers, and the lawyers kept complaining to the managers that the DOI was being constantly sued over violations of federal environmental law and losing because the district managers were brazenly violating those laws. And the managers laughed in their faces and said, "You do realize that if we followed the law, we would have every elected official, both state and federal, every county commissioner, shouting for our imminent demise. we will be pilloried within the communities where we live and within the agency itself. So we, as district managers, wait for environmental groups to sue us, to force us to follow federal environmental law so that we can blame the enviro groups instead of having the responsibility for that decision fall on our shoulders." And so that story really brings it home, or brought it home to me when I first heard it, because I realized, my God, they're really, these people are trapped. They're trapped in a rotten system. And to be in that position where you are waiting for citizens groups to sue you, to force you to do the right thing, well, that's pretty astonishing to me. Although it shouldn't be, given the general level of corruption that exists across every level of government in this country.
Well, I think another interesting point that you bring up is that this is not a recent issue. It's not a Republican versus Democrat issue. I mean, I think that's something, that's an interesting point to maybe you can speak to, that you're seeing in your book. You point out that there's this kind of oppression of the environmental regulations, in the Democratic administration as well as in the Republican administration. That's not a recent phenomenon, but this has been going on for decades.
That's right. So this is that is one of the key points that I make in the book. This is not some partisan issue of Trump versus Obama or the like. It is a systemic issue that continues regardless of the party affiliation of the administration in office. It is a question of capitalism and how capitalistic interests degrade our public lands because of the growth imperative behind capitalism. Capitalism states that we must constantly expand our profits, that we must constantly expand our activity for more and more and more material gain. The public lands suffer because of this. The wild flora and fauna suffer because of this expansionist manifest destiny impulse inherent to capitalism. So the rape and plunder of the public lands continues regardless of the figurehead in the White House. It really is about the system itself, and that's mainly what I go after in the book in terms of the polemical elements of the book.
So give us a few examples of the types of resource extraction or, harmful activities that are taking place on our public lands. Maybe, start with one and we'll highlight that and then move on.
Well, livestock grazing occurs on hundreds of millions of acres of land. It's the single largest commodity use of the public lands. It's incredibly damaging, simply because cows are an invasive species from Europe that require a lot of water. And that demand a lot of grass. And in arid country, which is most of the American West, you put a cow out on that landscape, that cow will eat away the grasses and trample the springs and defecate in the streams and cause incredible ecological damage. So you got millions upon millions of cows going out in the public domain, causing untold havoc on ecosystems. So that's one example. Another is just rampant oil and gas drilling. I visited a place in Wyoming called the Upper Green River Valley, which is it's in sublet basically the part of the, a large part of the Upper Green River Valley is covered by Sublette County, the seat of which is Pinedale, Wyoming. So I visited Pinedale, and then I spent a week and 2 weeks wandering around the Upper Green River Valley's incredible complex of gas drilling platforms. And so you're talking about a landscape that just 20 years ago was one of the most fantastic redoubts of sagebrush sea, of sagebrush steppe in Wyoming, where you had enormous numbers of greater sage grouse, which is an endangered ground nesting bird endemic to the American steppe of the West, and all the sage grouse are disappearing. The land has been subjugated almost totally for the one industry, for the one use. And that means crisscrossed with roads and pipelines and compressor stations and derrick platforms and jack arms and just, you know, just an incredible array of industrial equipment. And the air is filled with poisons and with and you know, the children in the nearby communities have to, one in three of children in nearby communities has to wear an asthma inhaler simply because the air is so foul. And this is air that was not so long ago, less than one generation ago, was one of some of the purest in the country. So those are two examples.
So I'm curious, when you talk about Pine Dome, and that's an area that I'm actually somewhat familiar with, and there are a number of big environmental groups that are doing some work in there on the pronghorn antelope and the sage grouse and all that. And you mentioned earlier that, you know, some of these regulatory agencies are just waiting for these groups to sue them to force them to take action. Are you seeing that they're being effective in areas like Pinedale? Is that enough? I mean, it seems, you know, there is some work being done, but clearly not enough. And why is that? And what can be done? You know, what is, if they're not doing the right job, who can?
Well, look, I think the problem with a place like Pinedale is that this is an example where the so-called multiple use mandate of the public lands regulatory agencies comes into play. Mm-hmm. So if you have a series of rubber stamped environmental assessments, and sometimes the more expansive environmental impact statements that say, well, this oil and gas drilling in the Pinedale complex, as it's known, is not going to ultimately negatively affect sage grouse or the migration of pronghorn antelope or the health of the sage steppe or the diversity of grasses that live mixed in with healthy sagebrush habitat. Well, then you've satisfied the multiple use mandate, even though the proof on the ground might be otherwise. And so proving that you have this widespread destruction of habitat, proving that you have a decline in the number of sage grouse, and then bringing that to court, finding a judge who is sympathetic to this argument and who might not be so sympathetic to the more simplistic argument that, hey, this industry is bringing lots of revenue and jobs, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very hard road to walk. It's an extreme uphill climb. And so, you know, you face a simple difficulty that we live in a society that places more premium on jobs, economic growth, than it does on biodiversity and wildland health. And that's just the nature of our society.
So one of the other impacts on our public lands that you take on is one that I think we hear a lot less about, and that's sort of tourism, like the impacts of what I think you call like mass industrial tourism on these lands. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I think the key factor in considering mass industrial recreation is simply the carbon footprint involved. So you have, at present, you have many, many environmental groups, conservation groups, green groups, et cetera, that have either said nothing about industrial tourism and mass recreation or actively espouse it as an alternative to the dirty old West economy of extraction. But you know, I make this clear in my book, industrial tourism is an industry that depends totally on fossil fuels. The carbon footprint from industrial tourism worldwide is enormous. So if you're a conservation group purporting to be green and you're advocating for industrial tourism, what you're really advocating for is further saturation of the carbon sink to further accelerate climate upheaval and eventual collapse. So that doesn't really make sense to me, unless you, as is the case with, again, numerous environmental groups, unless you're actually taking money from industries such as Patagonia, REI, and the like, that that benefit from more industrial tourism and mass recreation, especially on the public lands.
So part of the argument about mass, I mean, not mass tourism, but getting people into the outdoors is how can they love a place they don't know? What would be your response to that? Is if you say, okay, great, you know, it's this huge impact to bring people into Yosemite's and Yellowstone, you know, they're being loved to death, right? You know, beyond the carbon footprint, but just the mass amount of people in these places is, you know, has a high impact. But how else do you get people to care about a place if you, I grew up in New York City. I mean, if you had never left New York to go see a Yellowstone or to go to Montana to Glacier National Park, how would you incite that, you know, how would you inspire people to want to protect that land and fight against these big industries if they've never seen it?
The notion that that visiting a place leads to political engagement for its protection is a fallacy. It is bandied about constantly, but there's no real proof that that the two are connected. They are correlated, but not to the extent that that people would, that, for example, enviro groups would like you to think. I think actually what happens when people go out and landscape is they like the vistas, they like the fast food vistas, but in terms of actually engaging to protect that land for other values than simple human use, and that's really the question that I'm trying to get at or trying to answer in my book, how do we protect these lands for the other than human purposes that they for other than human expressions, if you will, expressions of life, right? The whole vast, biodiverse, biotic systems out there. Well, guess what? Going to visit national parks and going to visit public lands doesn't necessarily lead to engagement with these more complex questions of how do we protect this land for not just human utilitarian use, and human utilitarian use, by definition, includes enjoying the vistas, enjoying the views, enjoying the wildlife, et cetera, et cetera. So that would be my answer to that question.
So we have just a couple of minutes left before we have to wrap up. And the book, of course, was just released a couple weeks ago on July 16th. And I'm curious, what has been your experience over the past few weeks here in, you know, how the book has been received and the public response to it?
Oh, the response has been overwhelmingly positive. The reviews have been, I mean, dare I say, spectacular. so I'm pretty happy. Yeah, things are great.
No, and you've been touring well around with the book.
Yeah,
you've been
on a book tour in Colorado, and Utah. Did a bunch of readings. Was on C-SPAN. Gave a talk at Fort Collins at the at an event sponsored by the college there, and by a bookstore there. And that drew about 250 people. That was a delight. So yeah, the response has been glowing. I mean, I've gotten a couple of people writing me saying that I'm, an agitator or a Tommy Pinko socialist. And I'm like, well, you're right. I am a Pinko socialist. You got it.
Well
done.
Yeah.
Well done.
Well, and I've read the analogies with comparisons to Edward Abbey and Aldo Leopold. Is that something you kind of you like?
Aldo Leopold is a hero, man. That guy is, I mean, probably one of I don't know. I would say he is among the top like five greatest ecologist writers in the 20th century. Edward Abbey. I mean, Edward Abbey was great. His essays were beautiful. His novels were kind of silly, I thought. They're kind of cartoonish and crudely drawn. But Desert Solitaire is a spectacular book, truly an inspiration for me. You know, Abbey has some of his being compared to Abbey is not exactly it's not exactly wonderful in this day and age, given that he was a sexist and a racist. You know, that's not so cool, but...
Right. Hopefully but they're comparing about, him to the other parts of his life.
But what he wrote about the importance of wildland, of human beings' need for a relationship with wild, unspoiled, untrammeled places is, I think, central to the sane survival of humanity into the 21st century. We need to engage and re-engage with wilderness and wild places to learn our humble, small place, ourselves, in the larger cosmos, if you will.
Well, with that, I'll ask if our listeners are interested in reading the book or finding out more about you. Where should they go?
We can go to ChristopherKetchum.com, or you can just pick up, you can just Google the book. It's on many different websites for sale. It's published by Viking Penguin. But you can just go to my website, ChristopherKetchum.com.
Fantastic. Well, Christopher, thank you so much for joining us this morning to talk about the book.
All right. Thank you. Bye.